left off last week talking about the appearance of prophets. Haggai and Zechariah are the last, the last two of the last three living prophets in the Old Testament. And therefore, their books are some of the last to be included and trusted by the Jewish people as inspired writings. Theirs and Malachi, who prophesied, they believe, during a time when the people backslid, and we'll get to this period when we look at Nehemiah. Nehemiah was governor over Judah, and he initiated some reforms and went back to Persia and came back. And it's believed that during the time of his absence, between his 12-year terms as governor, that the people backslid, and this is these are the people whom Malachi addressed. And these are the last inspired writings. The Jews did not include any further devotional religious writings in the sacred word that they trusted after the death of Malachi. He was the last prophet. And during this period, we have the appearance of Zechariah and Haggai, who are believed to have been some of the deportees the people from Babylon who came to Jerusalem and were part of that first wave that came in with Zerubbabel. And we were talking about, we focused on the words of Haggai, where he reports them himself. He talks about his appearance in Jerusalem as he encouraged the people to return to the work. And in this verse, if it's hard for you to read these passages, I hope that's big enough for you, or you can turn to Haggai chapter 1, and he opens up at verse 1 through 15. And one of the things he throws out is, give careful thought to your ways. And this is one of the places where we can see that God gives us credit to have a head on our shoulders and a brain in our head to consider things. He gives us credit to be able to look at things and sort them out. And that's what Haggai does. He presents a situation to them and asks them to think about it. One note also in that passage in verse 4, he is speaking for God. He says, is it time for you yourselves to be living in your paneled houses while this house remains a ruin? This is a notation on what was the general look of Jerusalem and even around the building site, that the temple was sitting in the middle of a debris field. It was sitting among ruins, and it tells you a little about the people of the land, these people who were so proud to be Persian subjects and to tell on and inform against the Jews and complain about them. And they had moved in and taken over things. But what do you have? You still have this debris field. They had not done any of the hard work of clearing ruins and rebuilding. They didn't take on the tough jobs. They took the easy pickings when they moved back into the land. There is a verse that I was reading ahead on Nehemiah when he came on the scene. In Nehemiah 7, he makes a reference in chapter 7, verse 4. He came in 444 B.C., and this happens to be 70 years on down the road from what we're talking about now. because they rebuild the temple. It's 13 years later that Ezra shows up. 58 years later that Ezra shows up, and it's 13 years later that Nehemiah shows up. And when Nehemiah arrives in Jerusalem, it reads, "Now the city was large and spacious, but there were few people in it, and the houses had not yet been rebuilt." There were still areas of the city that were nothing but rubble. And you would think that this would be a matter of pride, that somebody would take on the tough job and say, "Well, I went in there and I cleared the ruins and the rubble and rebuilt something." The people of the land who are throwing themselves in the face of the king and proud of themselves, and "We're such loyal subjects," well, they weren't all that energetic about moving into that land and taking on and really bringing it back to life. They just picked the easy stuff. The hard stuff was left for the Jews. They were going to rebuild the temple, which they should, and they were going to have to rebuild the town. So when it says that his house remained a ruin, it probably, as much as they had done, it probably still looked in a ruinous state. But he challenges them, too, about thinking about what has happened here. For 15 years, you've laid off of this job. You had this contingent liability hanging over your head. In fact, it was over their head. It was up on the hill. They had come to that land obligated to rebuild the temple. That was the premise upon which they had returned. And they got scared out of the job, and they laid off of it and kept giving the excuse, "It's not time. It's not time." And you do have to use your head as you focus on what Haggai is throwing out to the people. In verse 8, he orders them, Haggai orders the people, "Go up into the mountains." He's quoting God, speaking for God. "Go up into the mountains and bring down timber and build my house so that I may take pleasure in it and be honored, says the Lord." And then he lays out the conditions for them to consider. Consider your ways. Look at this picture. You expected much, but see, it turned out to be little. What you brought home, I blew away. Why? Declares the Lord, because of my house, which remains a ruin, while each of you is busy with your own house. Therefore, because of you, the heavens have withheld their dew, and the earth its crops. I called for a drought on the fields and the mountains, on the grain, the new wine, the olive oil, and everything else the ground produces, on people and livestock, and on all the labor of your hands. You do have to put on your thinking cap when you look at this and consider this, because there are differing opinions on what Haggai is saying. When you have an economy, you have an agricultural economy, and people went back to work and they farmed and they had their vineyards and orchards and sheep and maybe wool industries, but nothing seemed to measure up. And when you study that passage, it never says that God says, "I'm going to turn on the taps and make it rain again." All these conditions that people lived with, if it's tough, if there's a drought, if you were a Jewish farmer and had a barley field and the next field is owned by an Ammonite or an Edomite, and there's a drought, it's going to affect him too. What's Haggai promising? What Haggai is promising to deliver, or that God will deliver is in verse 13. Then Haggai, the Lord's messenger, gave this message of the Lord and the people. I am with you, declares the Lord. That's the difference that Haggai is promising. If you were a Jewish farmer and you had drought conditions, and the Ammonite has drought conditions, what's the difference? You have God. And of all the things we value, God is the one thing that we should not leave out and should place primary ahead of everything else. We need to draw near to God, where what we do produce, we know is blessed. We don't want to go through the tough times that will have inevitably come in a tough piece of geography, an arid climate, hostile conditions. We don't want to go through it alone. We want to go through it with God, and God is promising, I am with you. Now, how do we make God be with us? I have these out of place. In looking at the situation, when I was considering this situation in Judea, where everybody's suffering, everybody's having tough times, we have Jesus in Sermon on the Mount, but I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. We should have regard for even our enemies, because God does. He causes his Son to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Yesterday, the righteous got some rain and the unrighteous got some rain. Because God's love is for everybody, and Jesus is pointing out God does not weaponize the weather. It is the solution to these people's problems is not that it's a tough part of the world to live, but they distanced themselves from God. They set their obligations to him aside. How do we do it? James advised us, if we want God near us, we need to approach him. James 4:8, draw nigh to God and he will draw nigh to you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners, and purify your hearts, ye double-minded. But draw nigh to God. You make the move. You make the first move. I can't think of a place in the Bible where God forces himself on anybody. Christ never forced himself on anybody. It was you who came to him. I mean, he came, he gave the message, but he didn't beat anybody down or force them to accept it. We make the acceptance. We approach God. There's even an Old Testament illustration in 2 Chronicles 15:2, almost the same thing. This is the prophet Amaziah, went out to meet Asa, the king of Judah, and said to him, Listen to me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin, in other words, not just you, king, but everybody. The Lord is with you when you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. Well, that's what's happened to people. They left off their obligation and their commitment to rebuild that temple and put other things in their lives ahead of this and shunted God aside. What they needed and wanted and nice houses and running a business or a farm or whatever came first, and they forgot about God. This is great advice where Psalm 127 begins. Unless the Lord builds the house, the builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the guards stand watch in vain. In vain you rise early and stay up late, toiling for food to eat, for he grants sleep to those he loves. The writer of this psalm advises if we're going to engage in any enterprise in life, God needs to be our partner. Jesus teaches the same lesson in the prosperous farmer who had a bumper crop. He had so much produce that he built bigger barns to hold them, and he just sat back and thought, I am so rich. I am so rich. But Luke 12, beginning at verse 20, but God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be, Jesus teaches. This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves but is not rich toward God. We never see this farmer think, well, I have so much produce. Are there any hungry people I can just give some food to? Can I hire some more people? Can I get people some work? Nothing comes to mind other than, boy, I really accomplished something and I'm rich. He didn't put up his treasures in heaven, remember. Put up not your treasures in heaven where moth corrupts and thieves break in and steal. How's that go? Treasures, moth corrupts, thieves break in and steal. Invest your... Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Where your treasures are, there will your heart be also. Well, that's not what these people are doing, and so this is the mistake they made. Well, getting back to Ezra reporting on these prophets, chapter 5, beginning verse 1, now Haggai the prophet, we just heard from him, and Zechariah the prophet, a descendant of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of God, the God of Israel, who was over them. Then Zerubbabel, Joshua, and Joshua set to work to rebuild the house of God in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. So these two prophets are there on site. And Zechariah has some very interesting comments. He does comment on the work at hand. Zechariah 8 in his own book reports this incident, and in chapter 8 beginning at verse 9 he says, this is what the Lord Almighty says, now hear these words, let your hands be strong so that the temple may be built. This is also what the prophets said who were present when the foundation was laid for the house of the Lord Almighty. Zechariah may be speaking in the third person, referring to himself and Haggai, that they have met. He says that there were prophets present 16 years before when they completed the foundation. So he may have been referring to himself and Haggai. He continues in verse 13, just as you, Judah and Israel, have been a curse among the nations, so I will save you, and you will be a blessing. Do not be afraid, but let your hands be strong. But in the same chapter, in the next verse, he turns from the actual, you know, construction, the construction work that he wants everybody to get into, to be brave, to don't be afraid, and to apply with vigor to the task at hand. He says, "This is what the Lord Almighty says. Just as I had determined to bring disaster on you and showed no pity when your ancestors angered me, says the Lord Almighty, so now I have determined to do good again to Jerusalem and Judah. Do not be afraid," he repeats. These are the things you are to do, and these are not construction tutorials. How to hammer a nail or lift a block or anything. Look at what he is applying these instructions to. These are the things you are to do. Speak the truth to each other and render true and sound judgment in your courts. Do not plot evil against each other and do not love to swear falsely. I hate all this, declares the Lord. He turns from their building a building, and he's talking about the elements of building up themselves as people, their elements of their character. He's telling them, don't be liars. Don't use the untrue lies like a tool. There aren't many places where it says that God hates something. But he certainly comes out forthright, and Zechariah says that he hates lying, people lying and being untruthful, and then being unfair. When you get up a court system, when you disagree with people, and if you have to take it to arbitration, don't be a liar and don't be unfair to one another. Don't go behind the scenes and bribe the judge. It's encoded in the law. Leviticus 19:12 says, "Do not swear falsely by my name, and so profane the name of the Lord your of your God. I am the Lord." There's one other place that is kind of parallel to this, where it does list, once again, it lists things that God hates. Comes right out and says it, and these are in Proverbs. These are the famous list of abominations. The NIV is a little easier to read. The word abomination is the King James Version, the way we probably read it first and remember it the best. NIV says that God detests, doesn't use the word abomination, but we think of it, recall these verses that way. It reads, "There are six things the Lord hates, seven that are detestable to him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue." There it is again. God detests a lying tongue. Once again, he's coming out against untruthfulness. "Hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked schemes." There it is again. Zechariah had said, do not plot evil against each other. God hates a heart that desires wicked schemes, just plotting and trying to get other people. "Feet that are quick to rush into evil," back to Proverbs. "A false witness," again, this is like court procedures, "who pours out lies, and a person who stirs up conflict in the community." When God talks about, when Zechariah mentions plotting evil against each other, this, of course, would stir up conflict. It generates conflict. And this is a scene that is abominable to God, to see people after one another all the time, trying to stir the pot, trying to keep arguments going, and keep everybody angry. And Zechariah is telling them, okay, you're back in this land, you're reestablishing yourselves, and this stuff is going to cut out. You're not going to be a bunch of liars. You're not going to be a bunch of, you're going to be united. You're going to exercise kindness, truthfulness, fairness, and you're not going to be squabbling constantly with one another. And this is the warning that Zechariah imposes on them. So it's not about building a building. It's building them and their character. And this is what God wants them to be known for, to be a reliable and truthful and decent people. He says more about the future of, that's again out of the Sermon on the Mount. This is what God expects of us. Be peacemakers. Be called the children of God. Not people who are always stirring the pot. We have further instruction out of Paul, talking about the acts of the flesh are obvious. Sexual immorality, impurity, and debauchery, idolatry, and witchcraft. Hatred, discord, jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition, dissensions, factions. This division among people and angry people, people in conflict, people driven by their own egos. This, again, Paul is still talking against this set of behaviors. We have go all the way back to Zechariah. We have the words of Solomon, and we have Paul talking about these, and they're called works of the flesh. And they're still condemned. They still are something that God doesn't want to see among his people. And, of course, Paul, in pointing out these works of the flesh, those who live like this will not inherit the kingdom of God. And as opposed to these, what are the good things that, again, he condemns? Let us not become conceited, provoking and envying each other, provoking, stirring the pot, conflict. Instead, he wants his people to be characterized by peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control. These are qualities that belong in God's people, they belong in Christians, and they certainly, sadly, would contrast us from the rest of the world and the way the world lives. But Zechariah points to a future glory that will come out of Jerusalem. You're rebuilding. This is a start on rebuilding this city. And in chapter 8, verse 20, beginning, this is what the Lord Almighty says. Many peoples and the inhabitants of many cities will yet come, and the inhabitants of one city will go to another city and say, let us go at once to entreat the Lord and seek the Lord Almighty. I myself am going. And many peoples and powerful nations will come to Jerusalem to seek the Lord Almighty and to entreat him. This is what the Lord Almighty says. In those days, 10 people from all languages and nations will take firm hold of one Jew by the hem of his robe and say, let us go with you, because we have heard that God is with you. Zechariah is pointing to a time where out of Jerusalem will come, and this is, again, this is prophetic language, and it's partly symbolic. It could be a messianic prophecy that Christ will be the central figure that people from all over the world will want to know about. They won't literally go to Jerusalem to learn and to meet Christ. They will figuratively and spiritually be able to join with the people who are God's people and be and find Christ and reach out to him. They'll come from all nations. And this sounds, this reaching out and trying to snatch somebody by their coat. And maybe if you've ever had to catch up with somebody who's walking away and they might not be able to hear you and you're calling their name and you have to tap them on the shoulder. You have to walk faster than they do. And you have to get them. And this it sounds like a desperate act, but these 10 people, these various nationalities and people of different languages are going to come. It's like an act of desperation. They really need this Jew. And reaching out just to grab his coat. What is this parallel to? It reminds me of the story of the pitiful woman in Mark 5. Who had the medical issue. It says in Mark, with a little more information, I think, than in the other accounts, that she had had it for 12 years, spent all of her money on doctors, and was worse off than when she started. And she knew that Jesus could heal. And she knew, she believed, all she needed to do was just touch him, and she would be healed. And she was. But she was desperate. Reaching out to touch the hem of his garment in an act of desperation. And this should parallel in our minds that we desperately need what Christ has. Not necessarily a cure of a physical illness, but spiritual, that and the world needs him. They need to come from the four corners of the earth, from all languages, and they have, to reach out, grab desperately, to because why? He is with God. And that is one of the things that Zechariah is foretelling as they rebuild the temple. Things seem to be going well because the people have returned to the work. They're stirred up spiritually. They didn't get more workers. They didn't get new tools or building material. It was a spiritual hurdle that they had to overcome. That inertia was a spiritual problem and not anything of a physical challenge. And they had progress. They were invigorated, and they got into it to continue to build. And so what happens? The people of the land naturally are displeased. Ezra says in chapter 5, at that time Tatnai, the governor of Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar-Bozenai and their associates went to them and asked, who authorized you to rebuild this temple and to finish it? They also asked, what are the names of those who are constructing this building? But the eye of their God was watching over the elders of the Jews, and they were not stopped until a report could go to Darius and his written reply be received. Now, they knew they had resistance. They knew they were displeasing the people, but this time they wouldn't be bullied into quitting. They knew they were supposed to be doing this work, and therefore they continued and were going. They weren't going to stop until the king himself said that they couldn't continue. So that's pretty much their reply. But Tatnai decides to write a letter, complain to Darius. About what's going on, the king should know that we went to the district of Judah, the temple of the great God. The people are building it with large stones and placing the timbers in the walls. The work is being carried on with diligence and is making progress under their direction. We questioned the elders and asked them, who authorized you to rebuild this temple and to finish it? We asked them their names so that we could write down the names of their leaders for your information. Well, now, aren't they helpful? What if Darius thinks, well, this is an act of revolution and these people should be executed? Great, I've got a list. Thank you. Are you Tatnai? Is that where the word tattletale comes from? But taking a name, getting people's names on a list and informing and supplying it to the government was clearly a malicious state of mind. If you want to act against them, we'll help you. They further report, this is the answer they gave us. And notice this. We looked at the letters that they write later and how they accuse the Jews of being seditious and rebellious. Well, they tell Darius, this is the answer they gave us. We are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and we are rebuilding the temple that was built many years ago, one that a great king of Israel built and finished. That was Solomon. But because our ancestors angered the God of heaven, he gave them into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. They report the answer of the Jews, and the Jews aren't even flattering themselves. They don't brag on themselves and say, well, we deserve this, and this is forthcoming. We had a nice temple here, and we want one again. And they outright confess, we betrayed our God, and that's why we lost it. Complete honesty instead of any kind of boast and any kind of misinformation about, well, we didn't pay taxes or we didn't get along with people. They betrayed God, and this is their own confession when they were asked, why are you doing this and what happened to the old one? However, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Babylon, this is still the Jews speaking, King Cyrus issued a decree to rebuild this house of God. He even removed from the temple of Babylon the gold and silver articles of the house of God and gave them to a man named Sheshbazzar, whom he had appointed governor. And he told him, take these articles and deposit them in the temple in Jerusalem and rebuild the house of God on its site. And this is the information the Jews supplied. And so the Tatnai and his associates continues in verse 16. The Jews are saying, so this Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundations of the house of God in Jerusalem. From that day to the present, it has been under construction, but is not yet finished. End quote. That's what the Jews are saying. And so the Tatnai says, now, if it please the king, let a search be made in the royal archives of Babylon to see if King Cyrus did, in fact, issue a decree to rebuild this house of God in Jerusalem. Then let the king send us his decision in this matter. So they do two things. One, they make sure that if there are any repercussions, Darius can very easily go send soldiers and arrest people and execute them. And for another, they're accusing them of lying. They're implying, well, you know, they claim this, but we're not sure. Why don't you look around Babylon? They're from Babylon, so look around and see if there are any official records that confirm this. Now, it should have been common knowledge, but this is what they insist that Darius do. Get some documentation saying that they should build the temple, and they're probably counting on it not being found or not existing or being destroyed and lost, and that would give Darius a means of acting against them. So the people of the land are not very friendly. They're still malicious and run behind the back of the Jews, and they're still trying to do them in and malign them and speak maliciously of them. So we'll leave that there and see what Darius thinks about when he gets this letter. We'll continue you next week. Any questions? Appreciate your attention, and enjoy the growing, greening grass that you'll be cutting soon.